You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Bricklayers Local 15 and AFGE Local 1336. Since 1865, the International Union of Bricklayers and Allied Crafts Workers has represented the most highly skilled trowel trades craft workers across the United States and Canada. Through local union programs, BAC Local 15's apprenticeship and training system is widely recognized for producing highly skilled craft workers. Safety and training are two of BAC's top priorities as well. Build with BAC. Quality is remembered long after price is forgotten. And we are the American Federation of Government Employees, the largest public employee union, proud to make America work, honored to serve the public, and appreciative of the Heartland Labor Forum. And we thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, last fall, Congress passed and President Obama signed a so-called Pension Reform Act, allowing employers to reduce or suspend pension payments to retirees if a pension plan is deeply troubled. Teamster retirees face cuts. On tonight's show, we explore this issue and ask if there will be a domino effect on other pensions. And then, auto worker and writer Tino Scalisi reads his short story, Huelga, or Strike, about a lefty Cuban immigrant turned supervisor and the crazy opening day at a not-to-be-named local casino. In the news, raising the minimum wage is all the rage in states and cities across the country. And if you have to be 18 to buy tobacco, why do they let children work on tobacco farms? Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. And now for the news.
And now for the news from our side. While Congress is mired in an action, raising the minimum wage is all the rage in states and cities across the country. In fact, now, according to the Economic Policy Institute, so many cities and states have boosted their minimum legal wage above federal government's $7.25 an hour, and that at least is 60% of the country's workforce that now lives in a place in which the minimum wage is higher. On Tuesday, Los Angeles committed to raise its minimum wage to $15 an hour, and that should be by 2020. Chicago is going to $13 an hour, and St. Louis Mayor Slay has come out in favor of $15. Here in Kansas City, the council has a window of opportunity to do the same before the long arm of the state legislator slams it shut through a preemption bill of dubious constitutional character. Some people are saying it's not whether the council will raise the wage, it's how much, 13 or 15. Mayor Sly James has committed to increase and set up a series of weekly meetings, and those will be between proponents of the raise and the business community, presumably, so that they can work out the differences. But in city after city and state after state, businesses tired old arguments that the minimum wage kills jobs, invites firms to move or go out of business, or is only for kids still living at home is no longer convincing anyone. So whether it's the fight for 15 by fast food and other low-wage workers, or fatigue at Washington's inaction, the momentum has clearly shifted to the workers' side. In 2014, voters in four red states, Arkansas, Nebraska, Alaska, and South Dakota, passed ballot measures requiring employers to pay workers more than the federal minimum wage, some with a cost of living escalator as well. And some measures didn't just boost the wages, they also featured that had features that pegged the state's minimum wage to increase the cost of living too. So, given overwhelming public support for raising the minimum, this could become a big issue in next year's presidential race. Hillary Clinton is for the raise, but she won't say how much. And Bernie Sanders, along with Martin O'Malley, have both come out for 15.
We all know that children under the age of 18 may not buy cigarettes because tobacco is harmful. So why is it that such children are allowed to work in tobacco fields where they get acute nicotine poisoning marked by headaches, vomiting, and dizziness? Human Rights Watch is calling on Congress to enact legislation to protect child laborers in tobacco. Bills introduced in the Senate and House by Illinois Senator Richard Durbin and Rhode Island Representative David Cicilline prohibit children under 18 from working in direct contact with tobacco. Current U.S. law allows children as young as 12, and even younger on small farms, to work in agriculture for unlimited hours outside of the school day with no special provisions to protect them from nicotine exposure. A 2014 Human Rights Watch report documented conditions for children working on tobacco farms in four states where 90% of U.S. tobacco was grown: North Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia. The report is based on interviews with 141 child tobacco workers ages 7 to 17. Two-thirds of the children interviewed reported the symptoms of nicotine poisoning while working on tobacco farms. Many worked 50 to 60 hours a week in extreme heat and also reported exposure to toxic pesticides. Health studies have found that nicotine exposure during adolescence causes mood disorders, attention deficit, and lasting cognitive effects. A U.S. Labor Department bulletin said that kids who handle tobacco have effects that carry on into adulthood. All the major American and many foreign brands purchase tobacco that has been worked by children.
Led by Republicans, with the support of a few Democrats who supported the trade deal, the House today passed a Trade Promotion Authority measure, 218-208. It will now be sent back to the Senate, where a more narrow band of Republicans and Democrats will be asked to approve it after already passing their own bill that included protections for workers, a provision favored by Democrats. That measure, called Trade Adjustment Assistance, was rejected by the House last week, part of an effort by Democrats there to undermine the overall trade package. To persuade Senate Democrats to again pass the trade promotion measure, also known as Fast Track Authority, Republicans have decided to tuck the worker assistant components into a non-contentious trade bill related to Africa and send it back to the House for final passage. Ask if both the trade promotion and the trade assistance provisions could pass, Representative Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader in the House, said, "I don't think so. No."
In some breaking news relevant to tonight's show, the Federal Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation will offer loans to financially troubled multi-employer pension plans, but only if they cut current benefits first, the agency said yesterday. PAI reports that in a rule to be published on Friday, PBGC said the loans expand its efforts to help prevent its insolvency of financially troubled multi-employer pension plans. Under the rule, troubled plans may apply to PBGC for financial assistance to fund a portion of their benefit liabilities in order to remain solvent. Plans that could run out of money within 20 years could seek the loans, it added. The nation's 1,400 multi-employer plans are jointly run labor management pension plans common in construction, food manufacturing, and other industries. They cover some 10 million workers. PBGC calculates plans over 1.5 million workers are in trouble. The new rules, which would take effect immediately, even while a 60-day comment period occurs, implement a law Congress passed late last year. The The law came after a joint labor management group that studied the issue for years proposed the small cuts in current pensions, along with higher PBGC charges to remaining multi-employer plans, as a way to raise money to pay for replacing pensions due to workers whose plans could go under. Before the Act's passage, PBGC's authority was limited to situations involving bankruptcy by some of the plan's contributing employers, and it required benefits to be reduced by PBGC guarantee levels, the agency said. But PBGC won't help a troubled plan unless it is already undertook all reasonable measures to remain solvent, including votes by its trustees to cut current benefits. After that, the trustees could seek PBGC loans to keep the plan afloat. Under this formula, benefits in excess of $3,960 per year are only partially guaranteed, and the maximum guarantee amount payable per year is capped at $12,870, applicable to a participant with 30 years of service and with an annual benefit in excess of $15,840, the agency notice says.
And tonight's news was read by myself, Beth Pike, Jen Zaman, Michael Savoie, and also Julian Scalisi.
In the year 2002, with 20 minutes warning, the Liberals introduced Bill 29. Only 3 days later, that hateful bill was passed. It offered BC workers bitter wine. The layoffs and the closings took their toll on patient care, with loyal workers laid off and locked out. With our collective bargaining rights denied by active law, our union's very future was in doubt. But we fought back, and we won.
Good evening, and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Michael Savoie, and my guest this evening is Karen Friedman, Executive Vice President and Policy Director of the Pensions Rights Center. Our show tonight is titled ERISA's Demise and the Domino Effect. Good evening, Karen. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
Very well, very well. Karen, it's been a lot going on since, of course, this multi-employer pension reform act has passed, and I was hoping you could bring our listeners up to speed on what has been happening since this bill's passed Congress.
Well, for the last 6 months or so, there's been a lot of folks all over the country organizing on this, particularly people from the Teamsters Union, retirees who could be affected, Teamsters for a Democratic Union, the Pension Rights Center, AARP, the Machinists Union, lots of letters have gone to Congress, the Treasury Department, which is authorized under the new law, just released today, actually, some proposed guidelines on how the bill should be implemented. So the Pension Rights Center gave some initial feedback, and we and others will, of course, be writing additional comments on that. And then do you want me to say tomorrow? Should I take that out?
Yes, yes, it's fine.
Okay, and tomorrow, the Senator Sanders and Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur are going to be introducing new legislation, Keep Our Pension Promises Act, which will repeal the worst provisions of the Multi-Employer Pension Reform Act and make sure that there's new ways of solving problems in underfunded multi-employer plans and getting some new money into the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is the federal private pension insurance program. So tomorrow there's going to be a press conference with Senator Bernie Sanders and Congresswoman Kaptur, and as I understand it, there'll be officials there from both the Machinist Union and the Teamsters Union, and then a retiree will be speaking from North Carolina, Frank Bryant, who is a UPS retiree with 31 years with the company, and he's a good, loyal Teamster who has been fighting this the Multi-Employer Pension Reform Act and is supporting Senator Sanders.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, perhaps you could tell us more about that at the end of our program today, because by then you'll have a firsthand report on it. You know, Karen, it's been my opinion that there's long been a concerted effort to undermine what I call a pension grab to attack America's pension funds. And I think we've seen that demonstrated by, just so many ways, the attempt to redirect Social Security, the public sector. We don't have to give them their pensions, or we can reduce it, or the compromises, the 401ks, the pension loans. But this bill that essentially undermined ERISA was actually the best indicator of this intent to take pension monies back from America's retirees. Could you comment on that?
As you know, the private pension reform law, ERISA, was passed 40 years ago in order to protect retirees and workers and protect the reasonable benefit expectations of workers and retirees. And this law, the Multi-Employer Pension Reform Act of 2014, essentially rolls back 40 years of protections, because what ERISA says the most strongly is that retirees need to be protected, and once you've earned a pension, it can't be taken away from you unless the plan totally runs out of money, in which case this private pension insurance program steps in to assist the plan, and then only then could benefits be reduced. And what this bill would do is, years before a plan becomes underfunded, the law would allow trustees of pension plans to have almost unbridled authority to cut the benefits of retirees. So once that happens, it opens the door for many other cuts of retiree benefits, and for Congress and state and local legislators to say, hey, this happened in the multi-employer arena, let's do it here too.
Oh, absolutely, and I've been expecting to see a lot more of that. You know, my pension is a part of the Teamster Central State, and of course, it's been in the so-called red zone. Yet, projections are, and this is Central State's projections. We haven't got the numbers to run an independent actuarial study, but projections are that it could last 20 years from now. Yet, there is a quick move to compromise existing retirees by reducing their benefits now. So we see it as the first volley, perhaps, in this war to take pensions back from American workers. If, in fact, this one is successful, why, we can rest assured that they'll be knocking on the pension benefit nearest to you in the very near future. What other pension plans have been under attack or would be impacted, let me ask, first of all, by the Pension Reform Act?
We know there is a list on our website. If people go to www.pensionrights.org, we do have a list on our website of plans that are projected to become what they call in critical and declining status, which would be the plans that would be affected by this new law. There's somewhere between 100 and 150 of them, although we have not been able to get the exact data, Michael. We were only able to have estimates done by the Center for Retirement Research on which plans could be affected. But we know that they're plans that could be in the under the construction workers unions, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, bricklayers and others like that. So there's industries that have been heavily hit that may in the future have critical and declining status plans. And once a plan meets the definition under the law, which is a technical definition, but we have fact sheets on our website that people can look at, it essentially means that if a plan is expected to run out of money in the next 15 to 20 years and has a lot more retirees than workers, then those plans, the trustees of those plans will be able to cut people's benefits to a legal limit, which is 110% of the insurance guarantees under the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. So while you know it's up to the trustees how much they want to cut it, we have a calculator on our website, which people should go look at. But under our web, some people have put in their pensions, and if trustees make a decision to cut the maximum, then in some situations, people's benefits, you know, retirees' benefits could be cut 60% or more. It sort of depends on what the trustees decide to do. You know, the Treasury Department has a little bit of authority to rein in that process, but, you know, the law is pretty clear that trustees are given a lot of leeway on how much to cut benefits. They can cut the benefits of retirees more than active workers. Once a plan becomes solvent, there's nothing in the law right now that requires them to make whole the retirees before, you know, restoring any other benefits under the plan. So it's a pretty unfair law, and that's why we're really happy that Senator Sanders and Congresswoman Kaptur are introducing the Keep Our Promises Act of 2015. And everybody should be, who's listening today, just write your members of Congress, senators and member, you know, your representative, and say, please support the Keep Our Promise, our Pension Promises Act of 2015. And by tomorrow, I will have a bill number which people can write into members of Congress and ask them to support.
Yeah, you know, Karen, I've really been impressed with the grassroots activity that sprang up around this attack on our pensions. I mean, I have been following it since before it really hit the fan, in a sense. As a member of TDU, while we've been monitoring the intentions of central states. In fact, we've been doing that for a long, long time. But most impressive have been the number of groups that have sprang up, state coalitions, retirees, groups that have been actively involved. I mean, every day involved in a struggle to protect pensions, not just their own pension, but certainly the integrity of pensions across the board. So it's been pretty impressive. Did we lose you, Karen?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. My computer board just went out, says signal loss, but now it came back on when I moved the mouse. Maybe it went to sleep. But at any rate, I have been just overwhelmed with that involvement. And again, I think it's imperative that America's workers understand that it may not be you today, but if this in fact passes, if this is
but
not turned around, I know it passed. In other words, if this is not stopped, this continuous attack on pensions, so it may be you tomorrow. And so I certainly welcome the efforts of Bernie Sanders and Marcy Kaptur in the House to get some legislation out there to bring this to public attention. Now, tell me a little bit about the efforts of other groups that have been involved, because I know since this attachment was made in...
AARP has been very involved in fighting the retiree cutbacks. The Machinist Union has been very involved. TDU has been very involved. The Pension Rights Center has been very involved. The Boilermakers were involved, and so were the steelworkers opposed the benefit cuts. The Teamsters, wrote a letter up when these benefit cuts were first proposed, and then they wrote a letter at the very end of the process. But they are coming out in favor of this new Bernie Sanders bill, so people should just let ask the Teamsters to play a big role in it, to really lobby it. That's what you know, they need some muscle, and the Teamsters should be muscling it.
Yeah, well, I guess it proves positively that the squeaky wheel gets the oil, because since this has begun, why, certainly we've had people coming out of the woodwork getting involved in the struggle to maintain our pension, our retirees' benefits in ways that will be viable and acceptable to everyone. If their cuts are necessary, then it shouldn't be just at the expense of working people. So Now, tomorrow, I suspect big day plan, from what I understand, maybe hundreds of people there on Capitol Hill to...
Yeah, probably about 100, 100 workers and retirees coming in for this, and many of them will be lobbying their members of Congress. And, you know, this means that, you know, it's the beginning of a process. It's not the end. There'll have to be more rallies, more agitation. And as I've said to Teamsters, it can't just be a Teamster thing, right? It has to be lots of union retirees coming together. It has to be, you know, we've got to get other groups involved. So hopefully this year we'll be able to do more of that.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think what's happening, I know we've seen, for instance, the attack on public sector workers in Detroit, for instance, was kind of scaled back. So it was a reasonable compromise. I know at one time there was a proposal there to take more than half of those benefits, and yet, you know, creative minds found a creative way to come to a reasonable agreement. So I'm in high hopes that that too could happen for the Multi-Employer Pension Reform Act. So I tell you what we're going to do, Karen. We're going to get back with you tomorrow in effort to get a recap on how the rally went and how the proposals were received by Congress, and then we could encourage our listeners to, you know, push the buttons that they can to get their congressmen and senators involved in this struggle. So with that in mind, we want to thank you for your involvement, and we'll get back with you and complete this interview tomorrow.
Okay, thank you so much, Michael.
Mm-hmm. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Karen. So, in closing, could you give us an update on the rally?
Yeah, it was fabulous. There were about 150 retirees there. Senator Bernie Sanders spoke along with Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur. There were other co-sponsoring people there. Frank Bryant, who's a retired Teamster, UPS, worked 31 years before he retired. Backbreaking work was there as a spokesperson for the folks who came in. He represents the North Carolina Committee to Protect Pensions, and he talked about how if his pensions and other people's pensions are cut, you know, it's not surprising if they'll end up on public assistance because, you know, they're all taking care of multi-generational families, and, you know, they've done everything right. They've been... they're the people who never asked for anything, and now their pensions are being cut. It was very forceful. Somebody from the International Teamsters Union, John Murphy, spoke on behalf of the Teamsters, and they say they are supporting this bill. And Robert Roach, who's the secretary treasurer of the Machinist Union, also spoke. So it was a really uplifting, great event. All the retirees had signs that said "Keep Our Pension Promises," which is, as you know, the name of the Sanders bill. So we're quite delighted. And now Senator Sherrod Brown is one of the co-sponsors. Senator Tammy Baldwin came on the bill. And numbers of other folks. So it's time now for workers, retirees, their families, their friends to get in touch with members of Congress and tell them to support the Keep Our Pensions our Pensions Act.
Promises Act.
Our Pension Promises Act is what it's called. Yeah. And so there should be a bill number right now. I don't have it on me, but if people go to the website of the Pension Rights Center, you know, we have material on the rally. We have material on the bill. All the information you'll need. It's www.pensionrights.org.
Okay, Karen. Yeah, I was just getting ready to ask you the bill number for our listeners, but they can follow it up on the website. And I also understand that the Treasury Department and IRS came out. In fact, PBGC
out. We haven't had an opportunity to really look at it yet, but we'll let you know, Michael.
That will be posted on the website. Okie doke. So yep. Once again, Karen, thanks so much for your timely information and keeping our listeners up to date on what's going on with our pension plans. And good evening to you, and thanks for being on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Same to you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Van Jones.
I want to suggest to you that we have a problem that we can solve. And in solving it, we will not only rescue and redeem the project of this green revolution, but we can rescue and redeem the country as a whole and help to save the whole earth.
Bioneers, Friday morning at 9:30.
This is Wilson, and I'm one of the newest volunteers here at 90.1 FM KKFI. If you would like to get involved in volunteering, go ahead and call Bill at 816-994-7869 or go to kkfi.org/volunteer. Thanks for tuning in to 90.1 FM KKFI, your community radio station.
Welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi. I'm going to be reading a story about a fictional story about a friend of mine when I worked at Station Casino back in Kansas City in the middle 1990s. I hadn't had a chance to write an introduction here, but I'm just going to go right into the story. "Close the door," Aldo said. And this I did. "Santino, I have information." This utility closet is just large enough to accommodate the one stainless steel rack, one mop bucket, one mop sink, two utility porters, and is located at the terminus of a subterranean serpentine system of concrete hallways which house the administrative offices, the nervous system of the entire multi-million dollar riverboat casino, which is, even at this writing, blinking and shining and whistling and ruining people's lives. The modern casino is a complex machine of supply and demand, and this demand is very real. The latent Midwestern desire to win is in the dirt like nitrogen. Thousands of overly made-up women and their ridiculous husbands, most in loudly colored jogging suits, they all stand rank and file like cornstalks at the slots. And these cornstalks, they smile, they cry, they scream, they smoke, they drink, they hang their heads, and they hold these little plastic buckets which, if they're lucky, will be filled with hundreds of little gold coins. Now, it's hard to imagine anyone having a problem with this new enterprise, but some do. Ever since that first gold-plated shovel broke ground on the northern bank of the Missouri, 5 miles east of downtown, people have protested. The casino, after all, has been making the promised industrial use of the area's natural resources, its land, the people with their time and talent and treasure, taxes levied to be used for area schools. But enemies exist, or so Aldo tells me. Aldo, he rarely moves, and it's because he doesn't have to. He relies instead on the service of others, and I have become, for better or worse, his personal secretary. We met before the casino opened, during an orientation meeting for newly hired housekeeping staff, where I had attempted to translate the proceedings into a language that he could easily understand. And like most recent American high school graduates, I could say my alphabet, I could count to 20 or so in Spanish, but not so much more. Aldo, fresh from Cuba, spoke almost no English. And together, we bridged this gap, spending after hours in this very closet with a bottle of rum and our Holy Bible, the Spanish-English Dictionary. And it was here where order and beauty and understanding replaced the stupidity of immigration and the arrogance of youth. I came to learn in the course of these proceedings that Aldo had at one time been a supervisor of men on the docks in Havana where he was born. And before that, an industrial engineer. And before that, a writer for Central de Trabajadores de Cuba's newsletter. His main area of study, outside international politics and women and jazz and rum, was accounting. Here in America, he cleans toilets. The ammonia vapors were very thick and nauseous, sealed off as we were in this closet, and Aldo would never say in a few words that which could be better said in a few hundred thousand, and I still had so much to do. My housekeeping list for the day was extensive, and so I had tried very hard to hurry him along, an effort that he quickly recognized, and as was his custom, he summarily blocked. "Señor, please..." But he raised his bony and liver-spotted, onion-skinned hand. He crossed his left leg over his right, produced a box of Virginia Slims. I still have no idea why he smoked Virginia Slims. They were sort of effeminate for such a macho guy. He lit up, drew the smoke deep into his lungs, held it, and closed his eyes. His eyes opened as he exhaled, and on that spiraling column of gray smoke rode one single word, the one word that would make things different. Huelga. I squinted, leaned in closer, shook my head. I lit my own cigarette as he handed me the Bible, and I asked him to repeat the word, and he did, followed immediately by another. Sindicato. Flipping through the pages, I said the words over and over in my head. Huelga, sindicato. Huelga, sindicato. Strike. Union. Strike, union. You can imagine my surprise. And now we were both blowing smoke into each other and searching for clues as to what would come next. What do you make, Santino? Now, he didn't really mean, what do you make? Like, do you make cookies? Do you make cars? It was more like, Santino, what do you think of all this? Well, I wasn't sure. Excited, maybe. The moment I discovered Aldo was from Cuba, I pounced. I thought that just being from Cuba meant that you're revolutionary. I was 18. What did I know? Although, in Aldo's case, I was exactly right. He was a revolutionary. He was a socialist. He had, in fact, met Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, Camilo Cienfuegos, and many others besides, in addition to his own personal involvement in and dedication to that brave new world that all those young and crazy and smart men and women struggled to create in 1959 Cuba. Excitedly, ¿cuándo? I asked. Next week, he said calmly. And with his help, I was able to piece it all together. Aldo spoke of a plan to strike the casino at a scheduled press conference the following Friday. Utility porters, cocktail waitresses, bartenders, barbacks, change clerks. Anyone involved in service personnel would be included. Aldo knew this because John Brancaccio, the CEO of Grand Casino Kansas City, knew this. The utility porters had been personally and thoroughly disciplined in the science of carpet vacuuming by the head of the department, executive housekeeper Larry Schmidt. A cowboy in personality only, who ambled with a gait so crooked and so handicapped that he had become the object of Aldo's very capable and side-splittingly funny imitations. The owner, John Brancaccio, likes vacuum tracks. Loves to see them everywhere. In both the casino and the hotel, but nowhere so much as in his own office and his inner sanctum. And before our closet meeting, Aldo was vacuuming the waiting area just outside Brancaccio's personal office. Soft classical music fills the air, source unknown. All the ashtrays quickly exchanged for new, the dirty ones collected in a steel tray to be cleaned later. The brushed brass ashtray near the elevator door has been wiped free of fingerprints with an oily solution applied liberally to every square inch of brass and stainless steel in the sprawling complex. And the black sand has been sifted, cigarette butts removed, the longer ones pocketed, the black sand raked and stamped with an iron bent ornately into the letters GCKC. And all the mahogany is in less than 5 minutes wiped down with oil. Satisfied that all was in order, Aldo reaches into his back pocket for the black plastic comb which he has ordered lifted from the hotel storage facility by the box load. He has hundreds of these combs, all hermetically sealed in cellophane, out at his cockroach-filled basement apartment on St. John Avenue in the Latino district of Northeast Kansas City. The door to Brancaccio's office opens. Aldo stands stiffly to attention.
Down?
Yes, Aldo, thank you.
No problem, Signor Brancaccio. You are my chief.
Aldo, we have a press conference next Friday.
It's a big day for you, Signor Brancaccio. Too much press, many, many peoples.
Aldo, I want you to speak. You know, you're my best man, my best employee.
Well, it's more than that. You know that. Signor Brancaccio, I am housekeeping. My English is no good. I had no experience on this.
As a parenthetical inside, Kansas City audience, this is total nonsense. Between the years 1961 and 1963, Aldo served as press assistant to the head of national distribution of propaganda and was also the manager of the newspaper Workers' Vanguard and administrator of the journal, which became part of the Ministry of Labor. End parenthetical aside. Both men stood silent at the elevator's threshold, the brass of which had been polished the day prior. You can still smell the Brasso compound in the fresh metal. Their hair was styled in the same executive way, parted on the left side. Brancaccio was taller, but not by a lot. He easily had 50 pounds on Aldo, who, soaking wet, couldn't have weighed more than 110 pounds. His diet, Aldo's diet, consisted mainly of rum and coffee and cigarettes and sometimes, on good days, pork and black beans and rice, but mostly it was just rum and coffee and cigarettes. I wish I had 100 just like you, Aldo, Brancaccio says, surveying the order and the antiseptic beauty and the quiet and the cleanliness. It was total silence. Then, a faint ringing of a phone from the inner office. Aldo, could you hold the door for me? Aldo snaps to attention. No kidding. Touch the inside edge of his hand to his forehead to absolutely nothing. Brancaccio is already gone. Aldo turns the salute into a middle finger and whispers, Hijo de punta. And all he could hear was the following words come out of the office. You find that son of a bitch and you bring him to me. Do you understand? Bring him to me. John, don't tell me to calm down. A moment of silence followed. At the press conference? A strike? Over my dead body. I'm coming down now. Don't move. The receiver slammed into the cradle, followed by another moment of silence, three more slams, followed by expletives. Next Friday. Flashes pop. Police sirens can be heard outside the doors, dinging of slot machines. Loud rock and roll music blares all around. The local press with their cameras set up near the podium. The public has been invited in for this conference to hear about the new casino, and Aldo is the first to speak. Brancaccio stands nearby, arms crossed, very proud. He salutes Aldo's direction. Aldo nods back, runs his fingers through his hair, and clears his throat. I place a box before the podium, and Aldo steps up and pulls a paper from his vest pocket and places the reading glasses that hang around his neck on the tip of his long nose and pulls the mic down to his trembling lips.
I want to thank too much my chief, Señor Brancaccio, and Gran Casino Kansas City for this opportunity. Today, this is the best day for me. Never mind, I think one day I come to United States. I have 65 years old. I am no stupid man, pero I am working class man, Latin man, Cuban man. You ask to him, he was pointing to Brancaccio, the work record of Aldo San Pedro. Every day, I vacuum, clean hood, a metal, trash can. I clean the bathroom or supplier 10 hours, sometimes 12 hours per day. You saw, pointing at his own eye, looking intently at Brancaccio. Many times it's not possible to eat, no money, no time. Many workers had the kids, a wife, husband. In my country, I study accounting. It's not possible to feed family $7 per hour. Señor Brancaccio is a boss. I am chief inspector of customs in the port of Havana in my country many years ago. I responsibility many, many, many workers. Never I think I am better than the worker. The salary to me, the salary to the workers is the same. Brancaccio, you act to me as a friend. Too much handshake and smile, la, 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 okay. And in the past, I have too much respect for you. You have surprise for me, Brancaccio. You are no good man. You are capitalista. Brancaccio, today, we, the workers of Kansas City, have a surprise for you. Kitchen stewards, all men, all brown, mostly Vietnamese and Latino, file quickly in on either side of the assembly, each with a manila envelope, which they open and disseminate to the crowd. The notice reads as follows. The past 6 months, we have been working long hours, sometimes 12 hours per day, 7 days a week, very often without lunch or bathroom breaks, preparing for this grand opening. The work is physically demanding, often unsafe and healthy. If we get sick, we can't afford to go to the doctor. We have no insurance. We cannot take a day off to be with our families or tend to personal business. Most of us in the service departments are new to this country. Many of us do not speak English. But we are human beings and we deserve to be treated with respect from Grand Casino Management. Our wages are some of the lowest in the city. We want what everyone wants, what John Brancaccio wants for himself and his family. Good wages, health benefits, paid days off, a healthy and safe working environment on the job, and the right to form a union to protect and defend our interests as guaranteed by federal law. And to that end, we, the service workers of Grand Casino, Kansas City, are now on strike for a fair wage, better treatment, and for respect. Thank you.
Thank you. you're right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams from the law offices of Angela L. Williams, here with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today, I thought I'd talk a little bit about a very exciting time of year for me as a lawyer, and that is Supreme Court decision time. Yay! There's been some pretty exciting decisions, and there are several decisions that are still outstanding, which are some of the decisions actually that are like the most watched decisions probably this term. And we'll talk about those in a second. But I wanted to first talk about one decision that was a pretty big deal that relates directly to employment, and that was the Equal Opportunity Commission versus Abercrombie and Finch. And that was decided on June 1st, 2015, just here a couple weeks ago. And in this particular case, the respondent, who was a young woman who is a practicing Muslim, was not hired by Abercrombie because she wore a headscarf as required by her religious obligations. And Abercrombie said that that conflicted with their employee dress policy. And so she complained to the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission. They brought suit. They won at that level. They appealed. They lost. They appealed again. They won at the district court. They were reversed by the Tenth Circuit, and the Supreme Court took cert. And in an extremely surprising decision, because it was written by Justice Scalia, and it was joined with Justice Scalia by Justice Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, and Alito, Thomas also filed a concurring opinion and dissented in part. They ruled in favor of the EEOC and against Abercrombie, saying that to prevail in what's called a desperate treatment claim, which means that they treated her differently because of a specific thing, in this case her religious obligation, the applicant need only show her need for accommodation was a motivating factor in the employer's decision not to hire her, not that the employer had knowledge of this need. So they had to show that they failed to hire her because of her religion. And that's it. The lower courts had said that the employer had to also know of this need for the accommodation and then fail to provide for that accommodation, and that was part of their decision. The Supreme Court said no, they don't have to have any kind of knowledge of the need for the accommodation. They just had to have failed to hire her because of her religion, and that's it. And that's a pretty good decision. And so I was pretty excited about that. I was also pretty shocked that I agreed with something that Justice Scalia wrote. So, two surprising things. Now, there are still several decisions that are outstanding. I'm going to talk about some of the most important ones. Briefly, there's a case called Johnson versus the United States, which has to do with whether mere possession of a short-barreled shotgun should be treated as a violent felony under the Armed Career Criminal Act, and even more importantly, whether the residual clause in the Armed Career Criminal Act is unconstitutionally vague. This has really far-reaching implications in federal criminal law. Also, Glossop versus Gross is about a death penalty case related specifically to the three drug protocol. Now, the two biggest decisions that everybody are watching are the decisions based on marriage equality and the decision related to the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act decision is King versus Burwell, and that is whether the Internal Revenue Service may promulgate regulations to extend tax credit subsidy to exchanges established under the federal government rather than just exchanges established under state. And then, of course, the marriage equality is whether or not the 14th Amendment says that states should or have to issue marriage license to same-sex couples, and secondly, whether states have to recognize marriages for same-sex couples that were performed in a different state. Both of these are very important decisions. Some people were expecting a decision today. That did not happen. So maybe they'll come out tomorrow. But either way, we are waiting on the edge of our seats for these two decisions and also the other two decisions that I mentioned. This has been a very exciting term in the Supreme Court, and there has been some very interesting decisions related to bankruptcy, criminal law, some water regulations, some Environmental Protection Act. Look on the Supreme Court's website to look at all of them. If you're a law nerd like me, you can read all of their decisions. You can also listen to their arguments. That's all the time we have for tonight. Thank you very much for listening. Get up bright and early tomorrow to see if the Supreme Court decides these two very important acts. I know I will be. That's all the time we have. Thank you very much. Be safe.
You're a Supreme Court nerd.
I am. I totally am. Last year, I won a poll, like a pool, on guessing and how they were going to decide.
You guys, take bets on that?
Not real bets, but like we're like, yeah, I guess we're going to do this.
That's
but
not legal, is it?
I don't know if it is or not, but we're like, I think we're going to decide this way or this way, and I won a lot of them. I'm a total Supreme Court nerd.
So how are they going to decide on the healthcare decision?
You know, it's... it's a really complicated case, and I had to read the several summaries of it and the arguments of it several times, and to be honest, I'm not even sure I understand a lot of the right arguments for it. I don't know on that one. I think that could go either way, because there's a lot of real complex issues about it. Because it has to do really not with the ACA, but it has to do with rules that the IRS is making.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's a pretty interesting issue.
Boy, it's a lot at stake there.
Yeah, it's a lot at stake.
Thanks, Angie.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And this is Judy Ansel, and I've got the calendar. So this Saturday, if you want to take a trip, the Mother Jones Monument is going to be rededicated in Mount Olive, Illinois, and they're having an open house for their brand new museum at the Miner Cemetery there. This is Saturday, June 20th, 10 a.m., the open house starts at 11, and there'll also be an open house on Sunday, and it's at the Union Miner Cemetery right off of I-55 in Mount Olive, Illinois, about an hour north of St. Louis. Also on Saturday, the Wyandotte County Third Saturday Breakfast starts at 8:15 for breakfast, and then the speakers are at 9:15. The speakers are David Haley and Kathy Wolf, and it's at Las Islas Marias. Ooh, Mexican breakfast. Yeah, 7516 State Avenue. Yeah, I might go to that if I don't go to Mount Olive. Turn up the heat to tune up the minimum wage. Monday, June 22nd, 5 p.m., City Hall. Everybody out. And then July 19th to 23rd, you can still register for the Midwest School for Women Workers. It's going to be at DePaul and Roosevelt Universities in Chicago. For a brochure and registration and scholarships, I don't know if there's any of them left, go to MidwestWomenWorkers.org. And UAW Local 31's Jim Wells Memorial Golf Tournament will be Saturday, August 1st. This is long-term planning. Sunflower Hills Golf Course in KCK. To register a team, call UAW Local 31 at 913-342-7330. And of course, you can find our calendar and our upcoming shows and our archive shows on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. We're always looking for volunteers. If you want to be a radio star, call me, Judy, at 816-235-1470. That's it for the show. Next week, our show is called Breaking into Fortress Europe, Migrants Across the Mediterranean. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.